to have the federal government seize voting machines? It's a terrible idea.
Democrats are nearing the end of their House investigation into the violence on January 6th. It's Friday, September 30th, and this is Hear It Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. We're continuing to follow Hurricane Ian today, as well as recovery efforts in Florida. You can find the latest at hearitnow.org. And earlier this week, the approaching storm forced the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol to postpone what was the final hearing on their calendar. So we wanted to take stock of what the committee has already learned and where its investigation could go next. We called up former Assistant U.S. Attorney Kimberly Whaley for that, and Scott Tong started by asking her what the committee is eager to finish before the midterm elections, when Republicans could take over the House.
Well, this election, this midterm election, of course, will decide whether the committee will continue to exist. And presumably, if the Republicans take over the House, it will stop. And investigations will shift to Democrats, potentially even impeachment of Joe Biden himself. So the committee has a few things to do. Number one is to produce a public record for the history books and to sort of raise the American consciousness around the coup attempt. And just to be clear, let's define. A coup is a sudden, violent, illegal seizure of power from a legitimate government. Very serious. So it's kind of telling the story, maybe getting people to vote. Number two, it would be a potential referral to the Department of Justice, written referral in a report for charges that would go beyond the 800-plus people on the ground who now have already been embroiled into the criminal justice system, maybe up to the very top echelons of the White House. And then the third would be to justify legislation to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future. The House passed changes, important changes, I believe, to the Electoral Count Act as well, I should say, and we're waiting to see if that makes it through the Senate. Of course, if the power shifts, then there won't be any legislative changes, which is unfortunate because we saw a lot post-Watergate after the last crisis of epic proportions, not as serious as this. And we just haven't seen it with the Democrats at post-January 6th so far.
Well, let's listen back to some key moments so far in the committee. Over the summer, we heard Pat Cipollone, then White House lawyer for then-President Trump, talking about voting machines. Let's take a listen.
To have the federal government seize voting machines, that's a terrible idea for the country. That's not how we do things in the United States. There's no legal authority to do that.
The committee hearings also revealed inside conversations about Vice President Pence potentially undoing the results of the vote, bringing in fake electors. What is the committee trying to do here, to message something to the American public or perhaps the Justice Department?
Right. So I like to think about the story as almost a play in three acts. Act one would be the planning of taking the election. Act two would be the actual day of January 6th. And then act three is the cover-up and reframing of it as the big lie. And I think the committee's done a good job going through all three parts of that. And of course, we only know a tiny, tiny fraction of it. But just to be clear, you know, they've established, I think, that this was not a sort of unanticipated event. This wasn't just a rowdy crowd getting excited unexpectedly. This was premeditated in that, you know, the defeated president spent 8 weeks orchestrating an attempt to overturn the election results, starting with court challenges, and then invoking Attorney John Eastman's plan to persuade Mike Pence to ignore his obligation under the Constitution to just, you know, gavel in the votes, to meeting with members of Congress to try to get them to reject election results, to trying to get fake electors, slates of electors, to then ultimately, you know, going down to the Capitol and making a speech saying, you know, I'll be there with you. And I'll walk down to the Capitol.
And legally, why does premeditated matter?
Well, you know, premeditated is, of course, a criminal term, and I'm not identifying any particular particular crime. But of course, we do know there are already allegations of attempting, obstructing an official proceeding. There are, you know, people have been charged with that crime, inciting a riot, inciting an insurrection, maybe even seditious conspiracy. There are a whole range of criminal statutes that I think, as Liz Cheney has indicated, at least some of which would fairly apply based on just the public evidence to the president. I mean, just to be clear, it's illegal to vote fraudulently as a single individual in an election. It's certainly illegal to try to thwart the entire outcome. That's just a matter of logic. And so the question really comes down to whether there's an appetite in the Justice Department and the Biden administration to take steps to actually indict people at the top for this.
Mm-hmm. And Liz Cheney, you mentioned we should mention that as co-chair of this committee, she lost her primary, so she won't be returning to Congress in January. I want to ask you about then Vice President Pence. The committee heard chilling tape from January 6th from the vice president's security detail, fearing for their lives. And we should note that the voice we're going to hear was altered for personal protection.
It was disturbing. I don't like talking about it, but there were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth. It was getting, for whatever the reason was on the ground, the VP detail thought that this was about to get very ugly.
We heard a lot in these hearings about the fear, the human toll, these remarkable close calls for lawmakers and the vice president. What do you make of that focus of the committee?
Well, that sort of is, I think, intended to wake people up to how serious it is. Of course, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Carolyn Edwards opened the hearings, saying it was a war scene, it was carnage, chaos, she was slipping in people's blood. More than 100 officers were injured, 9 people died in the attack or afterwards. And then there are people like Mike Pence who, you know, and we know when Nancy Pelosi, others, they were calling for their execution. We were a hair's breadth away from that. And then there were lower level officials within the election apparatus. Election workers Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman talked about how hard it was that the president publicly and falsely accused them of fraud, that they've feared for their lives. We heard from people like Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, or about them, or Arizona Speaker Rusty Bowers, that kind of adhered to the fidelity to the rule of law and have paid the price in terms of political pushback, and for some of them, real, you know, serious death threats, and they're ongoing. I mean, it's become now a liability in America for regular people to volunteer to do the sacred act of making our elections work, and those thousands of people are heroes. They made it work, a safe election in a pandemic. They are not people that are interested in fraud, and I think that's a story that we forget.
Okay, and I want to ask about then-President Trump in these hearings. We heard about him purportedly watching this all unfold on television, that he did not call for law enforcement backup. We learned that he demanded to be taken to the Capitol until his Secret Service officers said no. What substantive argument do you think the committee is trying to make with this focus on Trump?
Well, this is, Liz Cheney has referred to this as dereliction of duty, which is not a crime. I mean, it would be potentially impeachable, but within 15 minutes of leaving the stage, he knew the Capitol was besieged and under attack. Cassidy Hutchinson, aide to Mark Meadows, testified that he was told that there was potential firearms, and he said, "I don't care," I'm paraphrasing, that people have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. And so I think the idea is, not only did Donald Trump sort of knowingly call them to call the mob there, but encouraged potentially limitations and wanted to get rid of the metal detectors to encourage the violence. And for 3 hours, I mean, I live right outside Washington, D.C. I remember watching the TV saying, where is law enforcement? But just sat on his hands and didn't do anything to protect the integrity of the election and the human beings that were involved.
Great. Well, we have to go. We will potentially bring you back to talk about what happens next. Of course, there are witnesses and interviews going forward. Kimberly Whaley is visiting law professor at American University, the Washington College of Law there. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, new data show a tiny, tiny drop in apartment rents across the country. A report out this week said the national average of apartment rents went down, not up, for the first time in nearly 2 years last month. It's a tiny dip, and it comes off years of record rent increases, so renters are still struggling. But what does the data tell us? Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, joined Robin Young to talk about it.
Gosh, you know, the CoStar statistics, and you had a bunch of classifiers looking at it, including CoStar, Realtor.com, and Rent.com. Mm-hmm. You're talking about 0.1% up to 3% decreases versus a 23% overall increase in 2 years. Yeah. This has really been a market that has not helped renters, that has not helped first-time buyers. We've talked about it many times, and people have been squeezed amid the work-from-home move to satellite markets until, you know, the secondary houses that people have been hanging on to, and there's just been no room for negotiation. But there's a perception right now that maybe things have peaked.
Well, and by the way, I can't do the math. So like on a $1,500 rent, 1%, you carry the 3. I mean, that is small.
What was it, $15?
Yeah.
0.1%. I mean, yeah, 0.1%. It's not a lot. And again, you're talking about national statistics. There are vagaries in certain markets. Are people still getting work from home clout? Are they able to tell their managers that I'm going to roll this over? And don't forget that people sign up for 1 to 2 year leases. So this stuff is sticky upwards, and you see it ultimately reflected in inflation data maybe a year from now.
Well, you mentioned some things that are happening, and we know there was a pandemic, and we know chronically there's a lack of available rentals. Just not enough. But what else are you seeing?
Yeah, there are, negotiations. The renters facing these renewals, they're now looking for new apartments. They've just gotten used to paying more and more and more now. But as everybody feels this chill with mortgage rates and everything, with landlords, prospective speculators coming in, and Wall Street has been involved in this, maybe they have perceived that their clout has peaked, and maybe they're willing to back off a bit or to take the bid that certain renters have put in. Again, this is not conclusive data. This is just happening for a couple of months. You might see it snap back, and the trend has certainly been relentlessly upward.
Yeah. And how does remote work play a role here?
You know, you want to go into a satellite market. You think of Hartford. You think where I am, Richmond, Virginia.
Connecticut, yeah. Virginia.
In the past, you know, these places would have just catered to the corporations and the companies there. But if you're able to work remotely and take your Washington, D.C. or New York dollars over there, you have much more to pay. And the landlords understand that. And it causes a whole ripple effect up and down the market, and a lot of resentment towards kind of rental and homeowner carpetbaggers right now. You're seeing that in Asheville. You're seeing it in Portland, in Austin, and other places. And the question remains, how long will these bosses let people work remotely?
That is so fascinating. In other words, somebody working from a place they choose, I'm not going to even name one, but they're in the middle of the country or, you know, somewhere, and they're being paid by a firm in New York.
Especially with the white-collar jobs in tech and finance, where you're able to port all or substantially all of the salary. Other places are going to claw it back, saying, hey, if you're leaving San Francisco, we're not going to pay you San Francisco dollars to live in Richmond, Virginia.
Oops. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Fascinating. You know, rental prices have dropped just a tiny bit, but some of the reasons.
Yeah, move here, Robin. Move here to Richmond.
Okay, I'll be right there. Robin, thanks so much.
After the break, Robin speaks with New York Magazine's Olivia Nuzzi about why Hunter Biden's laptop still matters, despite the disinformation it has spawned.
A childhood friend whom I adore recently insisted Hunter Biden's laptop proves corruption by the Bidens. It made me think we have to revisit Hunter Biden's laptop. There are plenty on the right who claim that an email on it shows Hunter Biden was paid buckets of money to be on the board of the Ukrainian company Burisma so that an advisor on the board could meet with and influence his dad, Joe Biden, who was then President Obama's vice president and point person on Ukraine. Well, Biden aides have said they have Biden's then schedule to prove meetings never happened. Others say an email saying thank you for setting up up a meeting doesn't mean one took place. Our next guest says the data from the laptop has been through so many hands at this point, a cast of characters worthy of a caper movie. Who can trust it? But still, mainstream media should have taken a closer look. Olivia Nuzzi did. She's Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. She co-wrote The Opus, the sordid saga of Hunter Biden's laptop. And boy, it is sordid. And also a cautionary tale about personal data. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, boy. So 38 pages in, and we'll post it at hereandnow.org. We're left with some questions, but also this image of, you know, how this all started. A legally blind computer repair guy named Mac Isaac, a Trump supporter, who received a laptop that he says that, you remember, he's blind. He thinks someone who was Hunter Biden and who signed a receipt with that name might have dropped off. He goes to fix it. He sees a lot on this computer. We go down with him a rabbit hole. There's a lot of porn, very dark. There's pictures of the Biden family. There's ranting on texts about family members. But then the repairman comes to what those on the right, Biden's critics, are saying is a smoking gun. That becomes the thing that unlocks what?
There was a file on the desktop called income.pdf. And that's really where everything starts for him, is he opens up this file. And at the same time, that he was seeing all this and having quite a lot of judgment about it, the first impeachment of Donald Trump was going on. And so a lot of the names that were coming up related to Ukraine and Burisma and Hunter Biden, he would just sort of go and take a look and see what he could kind of analyze in the data on the laptop that was relevant to this impeachment. And he started reaching out, trying to get this thing seen by somebody. And ultimately, his failsafe option was contacting Rudy Giuliani.
Okay, so we remind people of that it was Rudy Giuliani was trying to get a Ukrainian official to dig up dirt on Hunter Biden because he was on the board of Burisma. But the claim by people, as you write, almost exclusively on the right who've reviewed this data or trust someone who has, is that not just that he was paid millions to be on the board of this company, we knew that, the Ukrainian company, mm-hmm. but that he arranged for the head of that company to have a visit with his father, influence peddling. Does anything from this laptop ever prove that?
No. I mean, what it proves is that there are communications that suggest that things like that might have taken place. There is an email in which someone contacts Hunter Biden to say thank you for having, said, it's in sort of broken English, but having set up a meeting or arranged for him to have met his father, who was then the vice president. And all of that would certainly, if it were true, would fly in the face of President Biden's claims that he had no involvement, no knowledge whatsoever of his son's business practices or his business dealings in Ukraine or anywhere. But that's all that it is at this point, is just kind of things that are interesting and maybe you could look into them. And some mainstream organizations have looked into those things at this point. I mean, the Washington Post has reported stories about Hunter Biden and his business dealings, or the Times has confirmed things that were initially in this data dump. But there's no, when people talk about, is the laptop real? Is it fake? Is the whole thing made up? What we're really talking about is this data contain legitimate information, or is this data completely like nonsense? Was it completely generated from nothing? Is it all just like political nonsense created by Donald Trump and his allies? And I guess the answer lies somewhere in the middle. It errs more on the side of it is real. It has now been corrupted completely.
Well, so I want to be clear. One who looks at this information can mm-hmm. see, and I think you have seen some of this.
Yes.
Yeah. And, painful photograph that should never have been seen, I'm sure you'd say, by you or anyone, of Beau Biden in his dying moments, mm-hmm. looking very frightened. Exchanges that Hunter Biden, we know he had he was a drug addict, that's known. He made terrible decisions, he has said, about dating his brother's widow. His wife has written about this in her book. Hunter Biden's written about it in a book, but it's another thing, as you really remind us, to see one person's entire life and all their mistakes splashed out there.
Right. I mean, even if he had lived an entirely saintly existence and never did anything objectionable, never arguably broke a law, it would still be appalling. I think it's a real, I mean, you used the word cautionary tale earlier. I think it's a real horror story about as we connect on our devices and use them as this kind of extension of our consciousness.
Yeah.
What becomes of that data and who has a right to it and when do you forfeit your right to privacy?
Yeah. Well, but it's all of that, everything you said. I mean, you're right that many have disavowed the laptop. Steve Bannon's like, it's a laptop from hell. It's going to take you down. I mean, many have just said, no, that it's don't focus on that. But there are questions like many on the right were claiming it shows how a Chinese energy company directed millions of dollars in consulting fees to Hunter and his uncle, Joe Biden's brother. This is another thing my friend said. Don't you know about the corruption with Joe Biden's brother? Is that true?
There is documentation in this data trove that does document these business relationships. But what's difficult about it is responding to your friends, say, right? What are you going to do? Are you going to go and get a copy of, are you going to go to my office and go into my desk drawer and unlock it and get a copy of this hard drive that was given to me by an abject lunatic and download it onto your laptop? It's almost like curated for people like me, I guess, for reporters who are looking through it. There was something called like salaciouspics.pdf. And it's like, you know, this is a completely corrupted file at this point. This is a completely corrupted device at this point. That's why you hear people like Steve Bannon, others who were involved in the dissemination of this data initially, why they're saying that they're distancing themselves from it or that it's, you know, it's over now as an issue, because they can't trust that someone has not along the way put something on there that is entirely illegitimate or potentially illegal.
But the Justice Department is investigating Hunter Biden for tax violations, money laundering, lobbying, disclosure laws, breaking those laws. He did pay a huge tax bill more recently.
But
is that investigation, which, by the way, what's your sense of where that's going, and is it tied to anything from the laptop?
Well, it certainly didn't originate with that. There have been some reports that claim that it started as early as under the Obama Justice Department. I don't believe that that's true. But the reporting about what they're investigating ranges a bit, but it's mostly financially related and related to his business dealings overseas and his taxes. It should be kind of concluding at this point, the grand jury. But I think the raid on Donald Trump's home and club at Mar-a-Lago perhaps muddied things a bit.
Yeah. So, you know, putting that aside, you also talk about how this did or didn't get covered. You remind us that mainstream publications, this was after 2016, when people were wondering, well, maybe they had reacted too strongly to information about Hillary Clinton's emails, and by the way, didn't even know about investigations of Donald Trump at that time. And also, all the major platforms were worried about getting caught by disinformation again. They were being so scrutinized. And this was considered, this laptop was considered disinformation. Do you think the mainstream media made a mistake in not taking a closer look at this laptop, even if some of the characters running around with it were kind of sorted?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was an impossible situation. I think there was a tendency to overcorrect in general on the part of the mainstream press in 2020 for either the mistakes or the perception of mistakes in 2016. I know I certainly felt that way. And I think that there was an abundance of caution.
But do you think if Republicans gain control of Congress, they will go there? There will be...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But even if that were not true, even if Republicans, in some alternate universe where they were like, it's not decent to do that, let's leave that alone, I still think it would be a mistake on the part of the press to have not looked at this. I think just turning away from something just because it's difficult and sticky and you don't want to deal with it and it seems like, you know,
it's
annoying.
Pictures
nobody
of
wants to,
people's body
wants
parts.
To,
yeah,
nobody wants to watch homemade pornography or call Rudy Giuliani, I understand. But I think it's just resulted in all of us who don't know about this thing being really in a bad place. You can't have a conversation with your friend. A lot of people probably can't have conversations with members of their family because they don't know what's what about this thing. And I just generally think that more information is better.
And so we will link them to your article to start. Olivia Nuzzi, a Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. The article is The Sordid Saga of Hunter Biden's Laptop. Thank you so much, Olivia.
Thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, check out hereandnow.org for a lot more from our radio show. You can follow our coverage of Tropical Storm Ian, our preview of the upcoming Supreme Court term, and a lot more. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Hafsa Qureshi, and Lynn Menegon. Gabe Bullard, Todd Munt, and Jill Ryan edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike and Max, along with me, Chris Bentley. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back Monday.